Hello, and welcome to AMO Kenzoku, episode 79. We are a group of four Bubblegum Crisis Boomer Otaku who talk about all things anime, manga, and other related subjects we find interesting. The Kenzoku are...
Hey y'all, I'm Mike.
Hi, I'm Dylan.
I'm Sam.
And I am tonight's host, Nick. We are recording tonight's episode on March 26, 2026, and the topic is Kiki's Delivery Service. So with that, Hashin. So what, I guess, initiated this topic was, I guess, in kind of the series that G-Kid seems to be going with, they are continuing to remaster, 4K remaster, Ghibli movies, and Kiki's was the next one up in, I believe it was March, right? It was about 2 weeks ago, if I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided, you know, we haven't really done a whole lot of Miyazaki stuff outside of Mononoke, and so, you know, Kiki's is definitely one of his earlier works. I believe was the year after Totoro, because Kiki's was made in, released in 89. I believe Totoro was 88. That's what kind of kicked this all off. I guess a little bit of background. Written and directed by, of course, by Miyazaki. I didn't even know this, but it was actually based off of a novel, which I totally didn't know. I thought this was a Ghibli original, but I guess now that I think about it, quite a lot of the Ghibli discography is actually original. A good amount of it's based off of some sort of usually based off a novel or short story or something. So as I said earlier, released in 89. And then I would say, as far as the rest of the core staff, a lot of the usual suspects, music by Hisaishi, as usual for the era. The budget was, I guess we haven't really talked too much about Ghibli budgets, but what I'm seeing on the wiki, it says it's about $7 million USD, which for 1989 probably was quite substantial. I haven't done the inflation adjusted cost for that, but definitely more than a Satoshi Kon movie, that's for certain.
Yeah,
but not a fair comparison, obviously. I mean, by this point Ghibli was very, very well established, and you know, I think was kind of in its golden run, as I like to call it. And then the box office, it looks like it did, at least in its original run, did just about $42 million. So, you know, I would say commercial success. It 7x'd its, 6x'd its original cost. One thing I didn't realize was, at least from a VA perspective, how loaded, well, I guess from my perspective, loaded this this movie was. I totally didn't realize that Minami Takayama was both Kiki and the artist character, I forgot her name, and young Yamaguchi Kappe was Tombo. I totally didn't realize that. It's literally been, I think, 35 years since I've watched this movie. It's probably the longest gap out of all the Ghibli movies. Which is pretty funny, because I historically speak highly of Kiki's, compared to, I like a lot of Ghibli movies, but I put this one historically in my top five. I think it still resides there, but it's actually less decisive now than it was previously. I feel like watching it, my opinion, the 4K definitely did this movie a lot of favors, especially given the setting. It was set in what looked like some sort of, you know, French/Italian city of the, you know, 60s and 70s, and it was a visual feast, to say the least.
Yeah,
the polish up was pretty nice. Obviously this predates CGI of anything, so it was all just, you know, the cleaned up hand-drawn stuff. Not the most action-packed Ghibli movie, not to say that they usually are, but, you know, I would say where it counted, the animation definitely shown. I forgot how cool the bicycle scene with Kiki and Tombo was when, you know, he's trying to fly on his bizarre bike with a super, super awkwardly mounted and dangerous propeller.
Can right we say, like, that struck me watching that? How, like, that guy, they go by a guy, like, on the street, and he's just kind of like smiles at them or whatever. And it's like, I would be terrified. Like, this thing is going to kill me.
But just, you know, how it was like the camera was following behind and, like, you know, Kiki was counterbalancing. It gave me, it reminded me a lot of, like, All My Goddess scenes when like Belle Dandy is like doing it. That scene was eye candy to say the least. But so I feel like I've jabbered on enough about the kind of background of it. I guess the first question is, were all of us able to catch the 4K re-release, or did some of us had to settle, air quotes, for a Blu-ray or something?
Yeah, I had to settle because it wasn't playing within about 3 hours of me.
Ooh, ouch.
Oof, brutal. That seems a bit, I mean, you know, not kind of, this one definitely was a little bit less, fewer theaters than Mononoke was for me. I did notice that. What about you, Sam?
Yeah, I saw it in the theater on IMAX. It was amazing. Looked fantastic.
And you, Dylan?
Yep, I got out, saw it. I've got so many comments and things there. On the theater thing, it was shown in 249 theaters. They brought in about 1.7 million total, which doesn't sound like a ton of money, but it actually averages out to, like, I think it's like $6,000 per, like,
theater
showing or something like that, which actually puts it as like the top, like, grossing, like, per, you know, showing for that weekend, which is like, all right, you know, that's pretty good. I think you could look at that and be like, all right, that's successful. It's not like it was like, you know, whoa, we put it here and did it. So it's a bummer that it wasn't anywhere near Mike, but it actually, I think it did fairly well. I'm sure it did as well as they were kind of hoping it was going to.
Yeah, I would agree. The theater I was in, it is the, I guess, my usual theater. I catch IMAX stuff in. Not super far from me. It's like a half hour from me. And it was pretty filled. Funny enough, about maybe three rooms behind myself and my wife was, at least as far as I could perceive, a Japanese tourist family that got tickets to the movie, because just they had a pretty heavy Kansai accent, and just the way they kind of were marveling at talking about stuff seemed more culturally Japanese than just people that were Japanese American coming to it. I left them alone, obviously. I didn't bother, but I thought that was kind of interesting. I suppose that because, you know, it's a G Kids thing, I wonder if this actually did not have a Japanese run yet, or if it was a long time ago. I'm unaware of of how, you know, these remasters are actually distributed over outside of the US, because, you know, G Kids obviously operates it all here. But yeah, it was a pretty filled theater. I'd say percentage wise, it was probably in the neighborhood of like 70%. But the entire row I was in was filled, so it was a healthy turnout, to say the least.
Mine was maybe like 50% was mine, roughly.
That was something like that for mine. I went to one of the sub shows. My IMAX had like a earlier dub. They had like one dub and one sub per day for like 3 days.
Sounds similar to mine.
Yeah. Yeah. I on coming back to a couple things you've already said is that I also totally did not realize that it was based on a series of novels. And apparently it's fairly kind of loosely, because I guess in the novels they're much more, there's six novels now. I think at the time that was done, I think there was really just the first one, which was called Majou no Takubin, which is a whole nother thing we can get into as well, the Takubin part and the name and stuff. But it was much more kind of smaller, connected, vignettes and kind of, almost kind of like short stories in there, but there wasn't as much of the big conflict and kind of forced growth and all the things. So the script definitely
that makes a lot of sense
diverged from the novels, because the novels I think were also written to be more like more just explicitly like a kind of like kids books in the Discord I shared. It has the first cover particularly has like some really cool art, really nice cover. And Kiki in the book and Gigi, they look fairly similar, but Kiki has she's got long kind of stringy hair, and apparently Miyazaki decided to be nice and shortened it for the animators to make it so they didn't have to draw long hair the whole time.
Well, we all know Miyazaki likes his female leads to have short hair.
That is true.
That's a pretty common, I would say, hairstyling of his female leads. I do appreciate you bringing that up, because one of the first things my wife and I discussed afterwards was that it, to me, it feels very much like Kiki's Delivery Service would be much better as like a 10-episode miniseries than as a standalone movie, just based off of how kind of the as you pointed, the kind of conflict and the resolution happened were just, to me, felt really like ham-fistedly rammed in at the end. Compared to like other Ghibli movies, I feel like it was not as elegantly sewn together of a plot. Mm-hmm. Speaking of plots, for maybe the, I don't know, three people in our audience that haven't seen this, do one of you want to take a crack at giving a brief synopsis?
Sure.
Maybe I'll just pick. Yeah, why don't you go for it, Dylan?
Sure. A 13-year-old half-witch from the country leaves home, as is the custom, to go find a new home to make her stuff for an unpaid year-long internship. She finds a lovely baker family that gives her a place that she can stay, and then she gets into trouble and grows and finds her own place in the world by the end of the movie and runs into some birds, and as we all know, birds are jerks. That's my summary. I'm done.
Okay. Yeah. And that's a good amount of the movie, actually. It almost feels like each of the deliveries could have, you know, been a standalone OVA almost, and then they could have just kind of continued, because I do feel like the time period from where she leaves to the very end of the movie at most probably is like a couple of months, maybe. Is what it feels like. It's not very long, because the matron of the bakery that kind of takes the first person to take a liking to her was very obviously pregnant at the beginning of the movie, and then she mm-hmm. pretty much has the baby by the end of it. So I would presume maybe like 3 months is what the movie and I'm not saying all Miyazaki movies take place over a long or a short period of time. It's just find interesting that not a lot of time goes by. From my perspective anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing I want to comment on is, I guess let's go from the angle of, for me anyway, music is always a big part of Ghibli movies for me. I mean, Joe Hisaishi makes some of the best scores. His best score. He's one of the best to do it, and some of his best works are Ghibli. That being said, it kind of surprised me that outside of, I believe the name of the song is The City by the Sea, which is basically the main Kiki's theme when she first gets out of the train, and I think we all know which song it is. It's probably one of my top three all-time favorite Hisaishi songs, but outside of that, the rest of the score for me was actually really, really forgettable. I don't know how the rest of you feel about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're thinking a town with an ocean view is probably the
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah. It's kind of a weird title, but yeah, it's like basically the main Kiki's Delivery Service theme that I think a lot of people associate with the movie. But outside of that one song, I really can't remember any other like unique songs from the movie. Like Mononoke, there is probably a dozen songs that I could whistle or hum to myself pretty much on recall. So that's how much I like that soundtrack. But Kiki's, yeah, it really was. I feel like I almost Stockholm Syndrome myself into thinking it had an amazing score when it was just, it has one really great song and the rest are just kind of there, is how I feel. Not to say that, you know, every single movie has to have, like, you know, 10 songs that are super iconic, but I think also the visuals really steal the show compared to the audio.
You could almost again, say, like, I mean, maybe this is not, I have a poor memory, but I feel like Miyazaki doesn't, he likes to leave silence in movies.
He certainly uses it well, but I still feel like with the other, my other, I would say, favorite Ghibli movies, there are still distinct songs who, where I remember yeah, sure. where exactly they're used. And I felt like with Kiki's, it was, I think it's because the general pacing and tone of the movie is so consistent for a gigantic run of it. Like, pretty much from when she meets the baker couple to the rescue, so to speak, at mm-hmm. the end. Like, the pacing and the tone feel pretty constant right. throughout that. Let's call it that 70% chunk of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what attributes the sound, like the music, to feel kind of samey and not memorable.
Mm.
But I might be overthinking it. I don't even know how long the OST for Kiki's is. I didn't do too much deep diving there. It may have had a shorter total number of songs compared to other films, possibly.
It is 36 minutes long, 19 tracks, and that's
pretty short.
And that does not include the excellent intro and outro songs.
Oh, speaking of outro, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like this might be one of the only Ghibli movies where instead of a standard black and white credit roll, it actually has kind of like a mini epilogue with credits on top of it.
Oh yeah, that was interesting.
It's not uncommon for Ghibli movies to have credits over stills with an epilogue. At least for
right, but
when series.
Actually like fully animated epilogue.
Fully
think
animated
of
is
one.
Not
Whisper
common.
The Heart.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. That is the other one.
But I agree, this one is done so, and it's so cool, and you get like a really nice bit of epilogue with it. And the song.
Yeah, you get so much out of, like, it was a quick credit roll. It was probably 70 seconds, but yeah. You get so much out of it, right? Like, it's so, I mean, again, the whole being able to tell so much with so little, I would feel like truly skilled, teams can do. And obviously, you know, this staff was absolutely loaded. I'm sure this is Ghibli in their prime.
I mean, this also, like, I got the feeling watching Mononoke that, like, I think even when we were watching Pat Labor movies, that, like, just way fewer people were involved in making animation back then. That was just really stunning and something I took for granted watching movies these days, and the credit roles are like,
and know. Like the army of people that are working, like so true. I mean, it's probably, I mean, the amount of keyframes each key animator was doing is probably like quadruple what they do now. I mean, Ghibli movies already have quite a lot of detail,
but now
so,
there's like,
speaking of
ultra specialized jobs, right? There's like a colorist
for sure
and,
mm-hmm.
all that's, you know, whatever.
True. There's you had to be good at, you had to be great at everything back in this era of Ghibli. Now you just have to be elite in one discipline, and then, you know, that can get you good work, I would say, at a reputable production studio, which is okay. Nothing wrong with being a specialist.
Probably more higher guns these days too, right? Like less staff, for sure.
This was another one that was fairly short turnaround, because I guess he had Miyazaki turned in the screenplay kind of after he took the first edition that apparently someone else had written, and he hated it, so he redid basically the whole thing. He turned it in like July of 88, and it was in the theaters in end of July of 89.
Holy moly, that is a pretty fast run.
Yeah, and it's it's hard to say if there was, you know, I'm sure there's already other stuff going on a little bit ahead of time, but it's kind of like, well, until we kind of have this set up. But if it's true, then it's like, all right, yeah, they just like, all right, we're good. Let's crank this out in a year. Gotta get this out.
That's another thing that reminds me of just how animation was back then. Cause I remember when we talked about Pat Labor, it was like from green light to theater, it was like a little over a year.
Don't even look up how long Castle of Cagliostro was, because it was short, is what I recall.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy how they got stuff going. They're like, hey, we got a little bit of money. Are we doing this thing? They're like, yep, all right, we're doing it. Let's just go. I was going to say, on the voice actors, yeah, like, I totally, because she was really good. Like, I didn't realize that it was Minami Takeyami doing both Kiki and Ursula.
Ursula, yeah, I know. Like, I was like, she changed her, because she, for me, I consider myself like an expert of hers, because she's like literally probably my favorite VA of all time. But Ursula was very obvious to me it was her. Kiki, it took till the very end when I was like, wait, is she doing double duty? I'm like, there's no way they would do that. And then I'm looking at the credits roll, I'm like, oh, holy smoke, she did do double duty. That's wild.
And then also kicking in on, like, let's just cast the entire, let's have doubled casting duty with Ranma One Half, which had actually just started airing in April of 89. Because you've got Minami Takeyama, Kafe Yamaguchi.
Yep.
You've got a couple others that aren't as much in there, but like Kiko Inoue, she's in Kiki. Koichi Yamadera does a bunch of various random little voices and stuff. So you're just,
yeah,
like,
he was the I believe he was the main cop.
Yep,
that kind of
they have enlisted as the cop and the baker and the TV announcer.
Oh, the husband.
Yeah,
the husband that says like three words.
Yeah, they're like, yeah, might as well. What a cool double duty.
What a cool dude that guy was. I forgot what a chill, cool dude he was. That baker husband guy was like, you know, no toxic masculinity. You know, he's obviously like a buff baker dude, but like, he's, you know, when he's showing off to Gigi and like winks at him, I'm like, hey, he's a cat guy. That's cool.
Yeah.
So
I asked my wife for her feedback after we saw, and she had a bunch of different things, but she definitely said, she's like, you know, I love the baker. Like, he's always like waiting for her to get back and like worried. And then he like disappears because doesn't want Kiki to know that he was worried or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just one thing I love is all of the kind of like mini relationships that develop in it. Although, man, I totally, again, because I was a dumb child, but that whole thing with the let's call it wealthy matron grandmother that made that weird pumpkin herring pie, that whole part of her, like, as for lack of a better description, like basically having dementia and like forgetting about Kiki, at that part kind of hit me hard. I was like, whoa, I totally forgot about this element of the story, because with the whole cake with Kiki's name on it, like, I totally forgot that was the reason why she made the cake. And yeah, that hit me and my wife pretty hard when that thing broke. Like, whoa, I didn't remember that element about it at all. So
what do you mean the dementia part?
Well, so she, because when Kiki goes back the second time to that elderly lady, she has a cake that says Kiki on it, and she asks Kiki, oh, I had this girl Kiki that helped me, could you please give this cake to her? Like she forgot, like it was like she was meeting Kiki for the first time again.
Oh, I thought that was a kind of a wink wink, like, deliver this for me. Like,
yeah, I took it as a wink wink thing.
Same.
I did not, because she kind of had, like, there's a pause, there's a scene, there's like that, there's that awkward silence where she's standing there, like Kiki's standing there with like kind of a, it was probably like a 3 second pause, and you can see, I this is how I internalized it anyway. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think that's, to me, that's how my wife and I both interpreted that scene.
Just
interesting.
But yeah, oh, maybe, yeah, so there, you know, the movie at first had, I would say, a pretty paper-thin plot, but there's definitely some nuanced stuff as far as, like, people's relationships there. Here's one thing that I definitely notice now, being a full-functioning and critically thinking adult, is every single child in that movie, aside from even not quite Kiki, but like all those kids were like basically like super wealthy nepo babies.
Like, yeah, I mean, I guess so.
All those boys, like, they're just able to spend all whatever their free time building planes and, like, you know, joyriding in cars. And, like, the girl, spoiled girl, whose birthday was in that mansion. And she's like, oh, my grandma sent this gross pie again. Ugh. And was like, oh, man, these are all, like, super privileged, spoiled kids.
Yeah.
As was my take from it. Like, they're all pretty awful children,
well,
actually.
Well, I feel like that's the impression the movie gives you at the beginning. Like, I don't disagree. They're clearly just, yeah, rich nepo babies. But, like, the beginning, they're kind of made out to be, like, Kiki's wary of them because they do, like stuck-up rich kids. But then, you know, when she gets to know them more, they're really friendly and kind people, it seemed like. You know, obviously not the herring pie girl.
Some of them, yeah. Yeah, I guess most of them, yeah. Like, Tombo, I think, was authentically friendly the whole time. Like, and, you know, he definitely showed that he didn't have any, like, ill intentions. Like, he waited an entire day for her, basically, right in front of that house and that thing. And then when she apologized next day, he's like, oh, it's cool. Here, come check this out. Like, he was super chill about it, which is neat.
The kids in the car, you know, the when they come to the blimp, they're like, oh, she's not going to come with us? You know, we'd like to hang out with
her.
Yeah,
true. Yeah. But then that's Kiki kind of having her scruples as like, oh, you're the girls that were at that party.
I feel like she thinks she doesn't belong off. Though, and that's kind of what I like that part of the movie where it's like it's a lot of Kiki feeling out of place, and then the people welcoming her and her kind of realizing that these people do like her. She doesn't have to
be. Eventually. I mean, she was kind of viewed as like a sideshow attraction when she first arrived in the city. And I mean, you know, that was obviously her challenge to overcome. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I also think on that part there with the, where Kiki walks off after the bike crash and then the friends drive up and stuff. My wife had the opinion. She was like, you know, that, you know, Tombo goes to talk to his friends and like, it just felt like it was just like very authentic that, you know, Kiki replies like, you know, without, she didn't really know why she was mad, but it was kind of like, she's like, oh, well, screw you. I'm out of here. And like, she can't even like really express why she's upset. Like she doesn't really know. She's just like, mm-hmm. No, I'm upset.
And that's okay. Right. She's a 13-year-old kid.
Exactly.
Right? Like that's okay. And I think that felt very authentic and real, and I was okay with that.
Yeah, no, that was exactly my wife's point, was like just that, like, yeah, that felt like very authentic teenage, young teenage reaction of like, I don't know, but I'm out of here. Screw you. I don't, why am I upset? I have no idea. But I am. Mm-hmm.
So am I the only one, my wife and I, are we the only ones that think that the whole thing at the end with the blimp was just like a really weird forced like conflict because why didn't they just let the blimp go? It's a blimp, it's gonna be in the air anyway. Why did they feel this need to hold it and anchor it down? We're both like thinking like, yeah, that would have pretty much avoided that entire last, you know, major catastrophe where it ends up going, you know, topsy-turvy, upside down, basically, and going, you know, crashing into and destroying the clock tower in the middle of town and, you know, putting potentially hundreds of people at risk. Like, that just seemed like a really odd piece of conflict for me. But I suppose, you know, that was the best they could come up with for, you know, how do we wrap this up?
Yeah, they certainly didn't make that clear. I could maybe come up with some guesses, but yeah, now that, you know, you mentioned it's like, yeah, why? I mean, I guess they were having people around it, like touring it and stuff. And if it just kind of let it go, that might be dangerous, maybe. Like,
but it's a blimp; it's just going to go up.
No, but I mean, the people around,
maybe
like,
diagonally.
You know, this
thing
tied down.
It's going
to
come down somewhere, and it's a pretty big thing.
So there was a whole like crew that was inside the blimp as well there, and like it. I don't know. I didn't feel as put off by that because it kind of felt like, okay, well, they had all the people there that were, you know, trying to go out and help and get this thing up and in the air again. And then, like, why not just
my point is though,
why not just let go and let it go?
Exactly. Because
they were all invested in it. There were a bunch of dumb guys that were invested in this thing, and darn it, we're gonna hold on to this thing until the end. It's our blimp.
Yeah, I guess. And then there was nearly a terrible tragedy.
That sounds like some great classic male thinking. Like, no, we're doing this the whole way through. I don't care. Tragedy be damned.
Yeah, I guess that's okay. The other thing, I think the only thing that, other thing, I guess, not the only thing, but towards the end that was not clearly explained, it was definitely left to interpretation, was Kiki's whole magic kind of disappearing, right?
What the heck?
That's fine. Like, maybe some sort of, like, you know, maybe the mental block of her being an angsty teenager caused it, or, you know, whatever. But, you know, she basically forced herself to recover in the face of, you know, extreme, like, pressure. Except, even at the end, Gigi never went back to being a talking cat. He stayed being a regular cat. And I have my theory on why.
Let's hear it, because I have no idea.
For Gigi, because I think it was actually Gigi not talking actually wasn't a Kiki losing her magic thing. It was Gigi deciding that being a regular cat was cool thing, because right around when Kiki was starting to lose her magic, Gigi was kind of gallivanting around with that white cat next door. And, you know, obviously at the end he has his litter with her, but I think that's basically Gigi being like, I'm done being a familiar, I just want to be a regular house cat, is how I interpreted it.
I feel like the way she was talking about it, though, like, she's like, I can usually understand what he's saying. It's almost like he is normally just meowing, and other people would hear meowing, but she, which the English or, you know, Japanese is her internal voice.
Mm. Yeah, that certainly is a possibility, because it never is very clear if Gigi is actually talking or if it's just what Kiki is able to interpret because she's a witch.
I do feel like that was my biggest, like, confusion with the movie, is the whole losing magic ability. I mean, as a plot device, it was very effective. And certainly I don't need them to really spell it out for me or whatever. But I feel like a little bit of, like, even just a why, a hint at why or something like that would have been nice, instead of like, well, now it's gone, I guess, and I tried really hard and it's back now. You know, that didn't quite feel earned. Although I enjoyed the whole process, right? It's still made very entertaining.
For sure.
But I was just like, what, but why? What happened?
Apparently that wasn't in the book, actually, the losing the magic stuff.
That feels like it felt so incongruous to the rest of the movie. So that it doesn't surprise me that though that element was introduced outside of the original novel.
But I think it was, to me, it felt, and there was part of her growing up and trying to, you know, become herself and finding her own way to have her magic rather than continuing to just either have things be easy as a kid and, you know, through to a, you know, understanding things a little bit better as an adult and, you know, losing it there. With the Gigi thing, in the original book, I guess it's explained that the witch girl and the black cat are, like, basically they're kind of paired up from infancy, so they can kind of talk to each other. And it's basically they can talk from their close relationship and not, like, an actual magic thing. But according to a quote that I found here from Miyazaki, the most important thing for Kiki is whether she can meet various people or on her own. As long as she is flying on the broom with her cat, she is free. But to live in a town, to get training, means that she has to be able to walk the town alone and talk to people without her broom or her cat. So I think I kind of take it as a thing of you know, maybe they can't literally talk, but it's also kind of like, well, it's a changed, a little bit changed relationship where it's like, okay, Kiki's, she's growing and trying to live and make her own way in this new town with stuff. And Gigi is doing his thing there too. And they can still be friendly and stuff, as is proven by Gigi coming back and wanting the attention, as all cats do. But in a different way, with a different relationship.
Yeah, the only cat I've ever seen, anime or otherwise, that can subsist off of pancakes.
Yeah, that was interesting to me too. Like, wait, what? What's this cat? Pancakes.
That's one of my favorite cuts, though, is when Kiki first goes out and goes grocery shopping. Like, just the... I mean, there's detail everywhere in this movie, but just, like, her reaching up and grabbing cans and, like, just that whole cut, everything was so painstakingly animated.
Oh, yeah.
Like, so very few background stills. Everything was, you know, was cells, and then was moving, and just, it was so bustling and active.
Oh.
Just all of those cuts where she's going around town, even when she's, you know, flying through town on a broom and, like, people are dodging and ducking and diving and, you know, or otherwise, just, like, gosh, like, I could just watch this, like, these cuts of this movie on, like, infinite loop.
Oh.
It's so, I mean, the backgrounds are gorgeous and the animation is just, you know, top-tier Ghibli. So, as many flaws as I think this movie has, I still feel like it, just from its technical execution and its artistic aesthetic, it holds a really high place in my Ghibli hierarchy still.
I mean, I will say that as a whole, I think the movie is really fantastic. It does have, I'm not going to go as far as to say plot holes, but kind of things that should have been explained more somehow. But despite that, it's a very good, coherent movie that, like, excels as a children's movie, but doesn't quite go that next level to excelling as, like, an overall audience movie. Because, like, you know, if you watch, I don't know, a lot of the better Renaissance Disney movies, right? There's, or like Toy Story or something like that. There's a lot of stuff for kids in there, but there's also a lot of stuff for adults because, you know, they're thinking about them too. I feel like this man maybe neglects the adults who are going to want to know, like, the explanation for why she loses her magic. But kids, they're not going to care. You know, it's just something you think about when you're older, when you watch this thing, go, wait a minute. But, like, yeah, I guess that's to say they don't need to, but for me, I wish they had. But still, I think a really great movie.
Yeah, I echo most of that. Yeah, I kind of get where you're coming from with the Disney comparison. But I still feel like, yeah, there's, I mean, everyone knows that, like, Mononoke is unmovable.
Oh.
For me personally. And even outside of Ghibli, like, it's in my all-time, like, criterion of all movies animated otherwise. But yeah, it's funny. I think Kiki's place in my impersonal hierarchy still remains the same, but for different reasons than I recalled. So my rose-tinted glasses came off, but what I found was actually equally, I would say, still stellar. I just forgot how technically, you know, incredible this movie really is.
From a technical perspective, this movie has always been what I've considered peak analog Ghibli.
Like, yes.
Just, yeah. They
very
had
handcrafted,
gotten their first few movies done, and by Totoro and this, they were just firing on all cylinders, had their formula for animation production dialed in, had Kondo, I'm not Yoshifumi, the other one, Kazuya, doing the character designs, and who basically simplified Miyazaki's style a bit and made it smoother for animation.
Katsuya Kondo.
The older designs, yeah.
And, like, yeah, he's done character designs for, yeah, like, tons of stuff in animation, director, I don't know, key animators on all sorts of things. One of those people. But interestingly, too, there, I think Katsuya Kondo, he was born in 63, so he would have been... like 25 when they made this.
Wow.
Dang.
That's so young.
And this was after he had already been a key animator on, like, One Amice and Castle in the Sky and stuff. So clearly a talented fellow.
He would have been in his, like, he would have been 20 when he did Castle in the Sky.
Then. Yeah, something rough, 22? Roughly something around there, yeah.
Holy moly, talk about, yeah, I mean, clearly.
They spotted him, clearly, and they're like, yep, you're coming here, buddy, you can draw.
And and then he got put in Ghibli jail for the rest of his career.
Hey, if you're going to go to jail, Ghibli jail's not the worst one to be in.
I agree.
Very prestigious.
It's almost, I mean, I guess they can call it the golden handcuffs of animation.
Like, technically, before we get too far off the animation stuff, I did want to compliment the... Like, you were talking about the backgrounds and stuff. I just couldn't help when the blimp stuff was happening and I was looking down on the crowds. I was just looking at all the individual people and all of their motions. It was just fantastic. Yes. Like, old man moment, but, like, these days you look at a crowd and it's like you're going to get this lifeless CGI thing.
Yeah, jittering CGI mess.
I mean, even if it's not jittering, they all have the kind of boring... you know, pre-scripted movement where, like, these people are all, like, reacting to each other and, like, moving and very lifelike. And they're just tiny dots on a screen. It was incredible.
Yeah, completely agree. Those, again, I think Mike's statement really rings true for me as well. It's just, this is peak technical, from an analog perspective, technical execution. It's I would say for live action, it would be equivalent to be, like, you know, like Terminator 2, you know, as far as James Cameron doing, like, practical effects. Obviously, T2 used CGI, of course, mm-hmm. but, like, the practical effects for, like, especially the future scenes and stuff where, you know, all those jets crashing, those are all just miniature sets that they, you know, rigged up. Like, stuff like that is just...
Not to mention stunts like the helicopter underpass flyby that Cameron had to film himself because no one else would want to take the risk.
Yeah, like, just that level of, you know, for lack of a better term, just, analog commitment to, you know, not relying on, you know, computers to do the heavy lifting for you. Like, don't get me wrong, CGI stuff can look phenomenal, obviously. We've all seen Marvel movies, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's an anime. I still feel like nothing really beats a talented hand animator, but... You know, I'm starting to be more okay with CGI, like Beastars. I love Beastars, and that's all 3D, mm-hmm. 3D CG.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's definitely, I can warm up to it, but this is just, there's nothing better. And it's kind of like, you know, it's like a fine, you know, vintage wine from an era that, you know, can never be replaced, that sort of thing. Fortunately for animation, it's not a, you know, finite consumable. As long as it's remastered and maintained digitally, then we should have it for the rest of all time until the, you know, solar flare wipes out all all digital data as we know it. But
and that's why we need to make our eternal Eva and send it off with a, you know, copy of some of these things in there.
Watch one time 50 years from now, they're trying to reconstruct some of these movies from, like, Ghibli museum bookmarks of release that have been made from release prints.
Yeah, or one of those super fancy pants, like super high storage data crystals where they, like, use a super high fidelity laser to, like, micro etch in the data into, like, a physical crystal.
Ooh,
and, you know, it can't be, it's almost like a modern version of a record where it's, you know, it's a physical, like, flaws that it's carving into this mm-hmm. perfect crystal to actually generate the data, something like that. But otherwise, you know, until then, I'm so glad that they're continuing to remaster the true classics. I'm sure when they get to Totoro, that's going to probably break more records, just from a nostalgia standpoint. I believe the next confirmed one is Whispers, which I'm super happy about because it's my second favorite Ghibli movie, but I'm also super sad about because as far as I see, it's only getting a one-day showing.
Oh.
And that's really lame because I feel like Whispers is super underrated compared to its contemporaries. It did come out in an odd era. It came out in a bit of an odd era compared to the rest, but it's, yeah, it definitely speaks to me. It's my wife's absolute favorite Ghibli movie, but my wife is also an aspiring creative writer, so that makes sense. But back on topic, like Sam said, oh yeah, you put it, like, just how much detail the background characters all got. Like, you don't see, like, repeat character designs. Like, you see, even in this one shot, you don't see a singular repeated character, you know, hairstyle, silhouette. You see different hats, different hairstyles, see people, you know, old, young, people with bald spots. Like, just the level of obsessive detail, let's call it. Let's be real. You know, it is Miyazaki. That went into it. Just, I can't remember too many other Ghibli movies that did crowds this large as frequently as Kiki. I'm trying to think.
Kiki is definitely one of the more urban Ghibli movies. So.
Exactly. Because, like Whispers is contemporary. It's, you know, it takes place in the, for lack of a better time, like, just from the 90s, but, like, there's never, like, massive, huge crowds, really.
Yeah, it takes place in pretty quiet suburbia, more or less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, suburbia and, like, a school that's not super crowded, because it's all, like, after class extracurricular stuff. So
speaking,
I'm hard-pressed.
Sorry, speaking of which, for where this movie takes place, found another quote from Miyazaki, which I think actually definitely lives here, which is, he says, you know, the town, it's a mishmash of various locales like Napoli, Lisbon, Stockholm, Paris, and even San Francisco. Therefore, one side is like the shores of the Mediterranean Sea, but another side seems to border on the Baltic Sea. One of the other places that apparently is a very, like, well, I don't know, attributed place for an inspiration is the Swedish town of Visby, V-I-S-B-Y, which is like a little kind of island town. But if you look at some pictures of it, you'll definitely be like, oh yeah, I can totally see why that's a influence. But again, I think the location makes it very cool, where you're kind of like, all right, it's kind of like, it's kind of European, but also kind of not, and it kind of is. And so I think his words there definitely sum up that it came out looking kind of like he wanted it to look, which is like this weird kind of mishmash of all of these different places, but it also kind of just works together.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're suggesting is that, you know, whenever some random Mediterranean EU nation defaults on their debts, Ghibli is going to open a Ghibli Park annex and possibly build the city there.
Yeah. One can only hope.
Because that would be rad. That would be super, super cool. Not for, you know, an economy going into default, but to see a real life version of this city would be pretty great. Where was I going with this? I can't think of too many, like, Miyazaki movies generally don't do crowds, right?
But
like,
when they
very
do, he generally does try and differentiate the people in them. Like, the only people that Miyazaki really makes faceless mooks are Lupin cops.
When was Cagliostro made,
Mike? 79-80.
79-80? Okay, yeah.
Like, there's definitely, like, some more kind of, not big people crowds, but there's other stuff in, like, a little bit in Nausicaa and more in Laputa with, like, the army people, like, in Laputa where they're ransacking. Mm-hmm. So there's stuff there, but it's not as much of just, like, people crowds, like, walking around, or people, as many, like, of the bits where you see Kiki's sitting there and, like, all the people walking around her on the streets and stuff like that. That's not commonly done with their stuff.
Yeah, I think he did some of that in, like, The Wind Rises, but that's the only other movie with some crazy big Miyazaki crowd work that comes to mind. And I know they spent an eon on some of those scenes.
It's another one I have yet to see.
And that one probably had a longer animation cycle than Kiki's.
Yeah, it definitely did.
All right, so I'll throw it out there that I've seen Kiki like quite a few times. I end up watching it for whatever reason a lot, and because I'm like, oh, here, you want to watch a good movie? We'll just watch this. Frankly, just like I love this movie. It at this point, I don't know. It might be my favorite Ghibli film.
Wow.
And I think for a lot of the reasons that that we said of it's just being like the execution of it for like all of like the technical parts and everything is like so nice, and you know, it's a good story, frankly. And then, you know, being 2026, you can walk out of the movie and be like, you know what? I feel a little bit better about humanity. Or, you know, oh, look, you know, these people were kind of jerks, but they kind of helped each other. And people were kind of, like, reasonably nice. And then you can even feel better about humanity from thinking of the production aspects of being like, man, people made this. This is incredible.
I mean, imagine how you'd feel once you rewatch Totoro and be like, you know, there is something to be said about moving out to the middle of nowhere, befriending random forest creatures, and just living the simple life. I feel like that is going to speak to a lot of people in this day and age. Yeah. As well.
That's definitely true. Yeah, that's appealing as well. But I don't know, like, It might be the thing where I would say it might be my favorite Miyazaki Ghibli film, which is a high bar because it's quite a few.
That's
films.
A very very high, yeah, bold. Bold isn't the right word, but that's a high bar for sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't think honestly, if you take Mononoke out of it for me, like they can all jockey for position. Me personally, after Mononoke, it goes, my top three is Mononoke, then Whispers, and then Laputa. That one feels the most, that's my favorite, I would call it classical era Ghibli movie. So, and then I would say that goes back and forth with Totoro for nostalgia's sake, and then I would put Kiki somewhere in that range, probably 5-6. So up there. For sure, especially compared to the overall Ghibli space. But if you talk about the classical era, I suppose it falls a little bit low, but it's not to say I think it's a poor movie, quite the opposite. I just think that they all are so excellent, and this one just speaks to me slightly less from a plot perspective, from a technical execution. There's really little I can criticize for it. I can see the absolute effort and passion put into it. I mean, just the key art. Like the bread in the background makes me is making my stomach rumble.
Yeah. I have that B2 poster.
I bet you do. What about you, Mike? You know, where does Kiki sit in your hierarchy?
That's hard. I was thinking about that as y'all were talking, and I don't think it's at my absolute top with Porco Rosso and Mononoke, and I'm still haven't quite figured out where I put The Wind Rises in there, because there are some things I really like about it and a few things I kind of don't. This is still in that, like, solid second group, the, like, A category, not the S category, along with, like, Totoro and Laputa. I might put a notch lower just because I love the animation in that, but it always runs a little long for me for some reason.
Hmm.
In a way that Mononoke doesn't.
I think A-tier is a perfectly good placement for Kiki's. Yeah, I would say for me, if I tier listed it, it would probably just fall shy out of S for me. But I think that's a solid take. What about you, Sam?
Well. Shamefully, I don't think I've seen enough Ghibli movies to rank it at all.
That's okay. Oh no, you've seen enough to at least five, right?
Yeah, I guess it's. I mean, it's really good. I really enjoyed it. I like, and I'm really happy that the first time I've seen it was in this format, in the theater, in IMAX remastered, and all that stuff. It was a real treat. Where it ranks, I don't know. Like after we did our Satoshi Kon kind of retrospective film retrospective thing, and how I remembered some of those differently. I feel like it's hard for me to place it. I mean, it's, I think it's definitely under Mononoke. But there's a whole bunch of those movies that I just, it's been too long that since I've seen them that I couldn't really rank them.
That is a good point. As much as I talk up Laputa, it's also been like pushing 20 years since I watched that one. So I might be rose colored glassing that one too, because Mike might have a great point about its pacing.
I mean,
so.
I do like Laputa is definitely one that ranks really high for me. I love that movie. But yeah, I haven't seen it since I originally saw it, and I originally saw it on like a VHS fan sub. that's like one of the very first anime things I ever saw. Well, not really. It was one of the later things. It was like at the tail end of VHS fan subs that I saw this thing.
Actually, Mike, now that I think about it, you were listing it, but you didn't mention Nausicaa.
Yeah, Nausicaa is in there with A as well. For
okay,
me.
Like, got it. I know that I don't want to say, you know, it's you have an irrational attachment to, but I know that it's one that really is near and dear to you. So.
I would say the thing I like about Nausicaa is that it is the most true to Miyazaki's art style of any of his movies, I think. Like, the character designs actually have that kind of squiggly look of his actual drawings in a way that the more simplified designs of later Ghibli kind of streamline away. And there's good and bad about it, because it does make the animation rougher as opposed to smoother with all of those quirks, but it just looks like Miyazaki's drawings brought to life, and that is really cool to me.
Yeah, so fair take as well. I really do wonder if and when they'll ever get to doing any sort of restoration of that, considering, you know, it is technically the first, so.
Nausicaa is technically not Ghibli, though, too.
Not Ghibli, yeah. It predates Ghibli as an organization, yes. So, yeah, I don't know what the rights situation is. I am assuming Ghibli owns the rights for it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's kind of interesting that, you know, the Fox Squirrel plush that they sell at the Ghibli Museum store is Laputa branded and not Nausicaa branded, and I suspect that is because they have the rights to Laputa, and Nausicaa is possibly more complicated.
Yep, I noticed the same thing when I was there. Yep, because we got one of the Fox Squirrel plushes for thing, and yep, it's Laputa, it's not Teto.
Huh.
Yep.
Interesting.
Another interesting thing on Kiki is that there was a dub that was made for it. The movie came out in July. There was a dub that was produced and released in November of 1989.
Just for Japan Airlines.
Yes, for JAL.
Which was not uncommon back then.
Yeah, I was like, huh. I was like, that's interesting. With the Carl Masek being the producer of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really interesting, like, that might be the singularly fastest sub-to-dub transfer of a Ghibli movie.
Well, there wouldn't even have been a sub at that point either.
Yeah, fair. I mean, you're right. Let's just call it Japanese language to English dub transfer. I can't think of another one that's faster.
Yeah.
So I did find that very interesting, because Totoro didn't come to the States until what?
Well, that was way later.
Was it way later?
I don't think Totoro came to the U.S. until the Disney deal. I could be wrong, but
so that would have been like what, 94?
Later, like 98, 96, 99.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I could be wrong on that, but it's.
I don't pretend to be the historian there. So.
I wonder if Porco Rosso had when Porco Rosso's initial dub came out, because I know Porco was originally a project for Japan Airlines that then kind of expanded beyond that.
Oh, really?
Huh.
I didn't know that.
It was originally just supposed to be like a 45-minute in-flight movie, quote, for tired businessmen whose brains are mush, unquote. But, you know, then Miyazaki got drawing planes.
You can't stop him. Didn't ever stop then. You're like, oh, you're going to pay me to draw some planes? Oh, okay. Cool. Cool. I'll draw you some planes. How many you want? No, you get more.
I mean, it's still really short by Ghibli movie standards. I forget. I think it's something like 81 or 88.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Porco is one of the shorter for sure. All right. Well, that hour really flew by. So, you know, as we definitely went over a lot of different topics regarding Kiki's, but any closing thoughts, statements? Let's start with you, Sam.
Boy, I think I was able to get out everything I wanted to say about this movie. Really great movie. People should go watch it if you haven't watched it, and I might be too late to watch the restoration in theaters. But, you know, go buy the 4K Blu-ray from G-Kids.
Or watch it on Max?
Oh, is it on Max?
Yeah, it's on Max currently.
Buy the Blu-ray. Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's too pretty for streaming. That's all I'll say, I think.
What about you, Mike?
I got distracted thinking about Kihara-san's story at Fanime about being the model for Kiki stepping on the broom and being sent by Miyazaki to go buy a broom first to do that.
That's relevant, and I forgot about that story. That's pretty great. I guess I'll go next. Yeah, similar to Sam, I got quite a lot out. What I will say is the one thing that Kiki did really well and kind of saved till the end was it really did a great job of kind of concealing the technology of the world. Like, Kiki had a radio.
Oh, yeah, the radio.
And that was really cool. And I totally forgot how much of the radio she listened to was all in English language.
Yeah, that was
like,
neat.
All of it, basically. I thought
not
that was except for the weather reports.
But after she left, that was, intentional that she was, like, crossing from the familiar into a more alien world.
But I love that at the very end, you see, like, TVs and a TV reporter and a live, you know, TV camera. I'm like, I've totally forgot this was kind of more in that era. So, well, yeah, I think that was kind of a neat little surprise.
I mean, the radio is small enough that it has to be transistor, so that's probably late 1950s, early 60s tech base at minimum.
But yeah, I was just a cool little extra detail that I remember that I didn't talk about.
And also in good detail there, that the English that was over that was clearly like well done, good English stuff, not some Japanese person being like, hello, I am here to voice thing. And you're like, no, God. You're like, no, this is like
this is racial stereotyping.
Yeah, hello, I am doing my best English voice. I am fluent in English. You're like, where you have a Japanese people
speaking. Put your glasses on.
Yeah.
Japanese people speaking
in
English.
When you actually look at the credit roll, there are two very obvious Western names credited there. So they were probably the radio personalities. But yeah, no, that was a great touch. Probably friends of friends at Ghibli who were like, oh, does anybody know Westerners? Oh, I think I have a neighbor that's from the United States. He works at Sony or whatever. So that could have been what happened. But
who knows? Could have been that. They could have gotten someone who is, broadcasting with the Navy base out at Yokosuka or something.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, possibly. Dylan, take us home.
I love this movie. I think it's fabulous. I did notice, two glaring, terrible animation inconsistencies. In Kiki's room, like, there's one spot where the picture of her parents is, like, missing from a scene, and the cat picture on the side of the bed is slightly different in, like, a couple of frames, so they should just be ashamed of themselves. When they're looking at some sodas and it's grape, but the G is missing everywhere, so it just reads as rape soda, which is, just a little awkward.
Ooh, cringe.
And then my wife's couple last comments on her, 13 is way too young to go out on your own. This is just completely absurd.
It's child abuse.
And then how did the crew get out of the blimp safely? Because they were a whole...
That's a...
there's a whole bunch more work to get them out. But it's a great film. I love it. I recommend everybody watch it if you feeling too much 2026 and you want to feel a little better about the world.
Feel like 1989 again.
But, you know, like the good part of it, yeah.
Yeah, fair.
So this plus Batman?
Sure. Yeah, they'll kind of even you out there. Yeah. You get your toxic death stuff and weird things and Prince music, and then you go over here and you get some really lovely chosen traveling music, which, you know, as we remember, was then reselected in Suzume.
Now I really want some sort of collab with Tim Burton and Miyazaki. I wonder what those two would do together.
I feel like they would just neutralize each other and it would just be a blank page.
Okay, and with that, I think we've covered everything. So, yeah, thanks for listening. And with that, this is Amo Kenzoku signing off. Sarabha.